Session number 13170.
Henry Brown, Reel 4. You were just telling me that the submarine was trimmed up.
Oh, yes, the L-27 was trimmed up and we got 3.5 miles on it at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet. Well, we did about a week's work on that, flying at her from every angle possible, and we got a maximum range of 5.5 miles. We went back home to St. Athan in filthy weather and wrote a report for the Admiralty saying, look, if you really want a decent range on submarines, you must develop higher gain antennae. And we set to work and took the Whitley aircraft as the first one, and we installed on it directional antennas on the side called Sturber arrays, and a whole backbone of dipole masts along the top of the airplane for the transmitter, which went in both directions. And then we produced narrow beam on either side, you see, the Whitley, by a Sturber array mounted on each of the flat sides. A beautiful thing, which was an absolutely flat sort of metal box, which you can put things on. And that gave a range of about, I don't know, 15 miles or something like that on a submarine, something like that. And those were used, called long-range ASV, fitted to Wellingtons and Whitleys, and were used in the Atlantic for long-range ASV. And it turned out that the ASV reconnaissance of aeroplanes was fairly effective, meter wave, but it wasn't really effective until the Lee light was introduced. And then it was introduced in conjunction with a bright light. Quite an interesting point, and somewhat analogous to the fighter realization that the difficulty of intercepting at night in an aircraft, enemy aircraft intercepting a bomber, until you actually do it, you don't realize that, you know, you need to know accurately, exactly and precisely where the bomber is. Well, in the same way, you know, when you want to kill a submarine at night, having detected it by radar, if you can't see the damn thing, you can't kill it. And that seemed a fairly obvious point, but it wasn't really realized at first until somebody thought of the bright idea of putting a bright light on the front of the airplane, which showed you the submarine. That was the Lee light. And then it was more effective. Then, of course, the Germans developed a listening receiver called Metox or some name like that, which picked up the pulses from the thing, and then they would just dive down when they heard the pulses, the warning receiver. And that put ASV, meter wave ASV for submarine detection, out of action. And it had to be replaced, and was replaced very effectively by centimeter waves later on.
But these developments and counter-developments occurred after you had left ASV development, did they?
I was in America. I, flying with the Falcon of FIU, I had a rather nasty accident at high altitude in a bow fighter. I was, can't remember what I was doing, but might have been, I don't think it was experiment with cannon, loading the cannon, but anyhow, I became detached from the oxygen while we were testing AI Mark 4A, I think we were testing it, I can't remember. I became detached from the oxygen for a rather long time, and Chamberlain realized I wasn't looking over his shoulder after a time, and he landed the airplane very smartly in the ambulance, and I was in hospital for quite a long time.
This was in 41?
Yes. Yeah. I think it was in 41, yeah. I lost the hearing completely in right ear, of course, and that wasn't anything to do with that, actually, matter of fact. No. Anyhow, I was told by the chaps not to fly high anymore. So I went back to TRE, and there was John Pringle, who later became Professor of Zoology at Oxford, we sat down and thought, well, now what can we do new with radar? And at that time we thought, well, the thing to do would be to apply radar to army cooperation, because that was the thing in the future. In 41 we saw the future there. So I went round army units like Old Sarum and places up in Lincolnshire, talking to the army about the problems of in which radar could army cooperation could air cooperation could assist the army. And anyhow, the long and short of it was that we came up with a system called Rebecca Eureka, in which we developed a small, very portable beacon, which on which you could home an aeroplane. But of course, we demonstrated that to the parachute troops. Sir Nigel Norman, for example, at Ringway, we demonstrated it to them. He was developing the gliders and so on. And we demonstrated it to him, and of course, they couldn't really take it up. And the reason why they couldn't take it up was that the aeroplanes belonged to Bomber Command. And so any aeroplanes which were used subsequently for parachute troop operations would be Bomber Command aeroplanes. And so the aeroplane installations were Bomber Command installations. And there was no question, you see, of putting special equipment on them at that time in the war, because they would be the same aeroplanes. The parachute troops didn't have their own force of aeroplanes. And so they had to put this thing on hold. They said, we'd like that system very much for dropping parachute troops, because we can't put this special equipment in the aircraft, the Rebecca, the aircraft interrogator. We can't do it. So, but they said, Nigel Norman, or somebody said, well, as a matter of fact, I know somebody who would like to use it. And so one day the SOE appeared in our offices in Malvern, in Swanage, and said, would you come and see us? So I had the rather ludicrous experience of going to see SOE in Baker Street. It was ludicrous because, in fact, it was so hard to get there. They were so secret, you had to go somewhere first of all to be identified, and then you went to Baker Street. Finally, I got into Baker Street, and they said, well, our problem is that we want to deliver loads for sabotage, train derailing, or blowing up an oil refinery or something like that into a field in Poland at the moment. Or yes, it was in Poland that they were mainly concerned with. And of course, we have to find a field in Poland in the dark with very little moonlight, very little surface wind. The reception committee must use a minimum of lighting because the Germans will get them, and it's damn difficult to do. And so I said, well, what range do you want? We could give you a beacon that'll do this. A small thing that you can send in with an agent. And they said, fine, that's just what we want. Well, we'd like a range of 20, 30 miles. I said, well, why do you want so much? How accurately can you find this field? They said, oh, well, you know, we're lucky if we're within 20, 30 miles of the field. I said, well, for heaven's sake, why don't you use G to locate yourself up to the Dutch coast? At least you start from there, knowing exactly where you are. They said, G? What's G? So I said, ha. I can't tell you, it's secret. And that's one of the most satisfactory events in the war for me, because they'd been so hopelessly obstructive about secrecy and finding the damn place in Baker Street. I was able to tell them that I could tell them that, gee, because it was secret. I like that very much. However, I went to see a man called Gubbins, who ran the whole thing, and we talked it over with Gubbins, and Gubbins sent me with a man called Sofiano to the Air Ministry, and we got permission to disclose G. They used G in the aeroplanes eventually. But anyhow, we built a beacon for them, and I trained a number of their agents, and we sent beacons to Norway, and we sent them to Poland, and we sent them to France. And what happened to them after that, I don't know, and you couldn't find out, because certainly no one was ever going to tell you. But I trained quite a lot of agents.
Why did Rebecca have two code names, Rebecca and Eureka?
Rebecca was the aircraft equipment, and Eureka was the ground equipment. So what happened after SOE used it was that the parachute troops, when Operation Overlord came into practice, came nearer and nearer the invasion of Europe, And there was then a serious preparation, so to speak, aircraft-wise for the thing. Then they started, of course, to place contracts immediately for the Rebecca system for the parachute troops and the Eureka for our own parachute troops. And then we had already built a system for SOE, so it was available. And the engineering was minimal to provide the parachute troops with it. So finally, the parachute troop force was, all these aircraft that carried parachute troops were equipped with Rebecca. And the parachute troops were used, and it was used extensively in operation. 75% of the drops were done by it, and 25% of them were blind. We demonstrated all these things, by the way, to all these people. I mean, to Army Corp and SOE and everything. It was great fun, really, demonstrating it to them. We gave them a beacon and said, take it away, in a week's time we'll find it. Rather fun.
It sounds as though you didn't have anywhere near such great problems. This work as you'd have with the AI.
No, it was all low altitude flying too for me. I was allowed to do this. It was all 2,000-3,000 feet. I mean, 20,000 feet is a different thing. No, we didn't have the same problems. No, and then of course what happened is that the Americans said, "Look here, we must have this system. We must have this system." So I was sent to America with a Dakota, equipped with Rebecca Eureka. And I flew all around the States demonstrating the thing in Fort Bragg and all these places. You know, rather fun. You drop sort of a bag of flour or something on a target or something. And I persuaded them to adopt a system which was consistent with ours. It wasn't identical technically because I couldn't get them to use exactly the same things as we did, of course, because they had their own ideas. It took quite a long time to do that. Anyhow, it was successful. And in Operation Overlord, when the Americans were over here, at least half their operational channels and so on worked together with ours. I know nothing much about that because by that I was in America and I was posted to work for the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. A British team was set up there to work on a marvelous project called United Nations Beacons and Identification, UNBIF. It was Allied Identification System for beacons and IFF. It was going to be used by all the Allies at every theatre. Totally interchangeable, used by the Navy and the Army and the Air Force and everything. And it worked on 900 megahertz. We had to pioneer the wave band of 900 megahertz. We spent millions of dollars on it. And I was in charge of the system. I was assistant head of the combined research group for system design. The British head was a man called Lord Bowden, great friend of mine, Lord Vivian Bowden, later head of UMIST in Manchester. Marvellous chap, great fun. And we had a team of about 13 people. We borrowed one man from Canada, one man from New Zealand, one man from Australia, I think, and the rest from England.
According to the form you filled out here, this period in America was from 42 to 45, second half of the war.
Yes, that's right. Yes. So I was isolated. I mean, we worked extremely hard. It was highly technical. It was really highly technical, and it was totally absorbing in that sense, totally absorbing. I acted as liaison officer with the radiation lab as well. Once a month I had to go to the radiation lab, and I met all the buds and all the chaps in that game. You know, Rabi and DeBridge and Alvarez and Bacher and all of them in the radiation lab.
How was it working in the USA during wartime?
Oh, it was very good, really. Very professional. A bit different, of course, to working in England, because we were trying to get stuff developed and put into production. And when you're dealing with firms like RCA and so on that are customed, or in Chicago it was Zenith or something like that, which is where I incidentally got the Rebecca Eureka made in RCA and in Chicago by Zenith and Galvin, you're dealing with people who are accustomed to making hundreds of thousands of sets, not just a few. And so you have these production engineers who come in, you see. And they need drawings and absolutely precise details of what you want. And we weren't used to that. We used to go to E.K. Cole's or Pies or so somewhere like that and say, look, chaps, this is about what we want, you know. There was a sort of different sort of flexibility, if you understand what I'm driving at. The Americans were very professional. They had to know exactly what it was, you know. They were accustomed to making hundreds of thousands, not a few things. That was different. So you were dealing with a very professional environment. Good people. Rather too much bureaucracy. In the Pentagon, for example, drive you absolutely insane. I mean, dealing with a sort of scores and scores of people in the Pentagon, and, you know, levels of lieutenant colonels and majors and things, you know. Fairly. And it's a very much larger organization than England.
You briefly mentioned something about the characteristics of Watson Watt.
Oh, yes.
And how his rather difficult method of explaining things. Yeah. Could you say something more about him?
I've just given a lecture in London on Watson Watt. As a matter of fact, the IE, I had standing room only, so I'm glad about that. It was very badly advertised. It's 100 years, 101 years, actually, since he was born. And
1892.
So I gave a lecture on him, yes, and illustrated it quite well, actually. I tried to persuade the IE to publish it. I wish they would.
But what was he like to work for?
Oh, well, he was an unusual person. He's a very courageous person, very urbane, very entertaining, very interested in anything, marvellous memory, considerable sense of humour, a very real sense of his own importance, and a very involved sort of not an easy man, not a man's man, you know what I mean. He was probably much better with women than men, I think. He wasn't a sort of man's man. He wasn't the sort of man you go into a pub and have a drink with, you see. He wasn't that sort of chap. He was much more sort of academics and sort of, you know, difficult to say what I don't quite
not
know.
Not clubbable.
Not that. But very entertaining all the same, but very roundabout in speech. As I said, one of my favourite quotations from him is that I heard one of the workshop men in... he was a great figure in the Institute of Professional Civil Servants, and he established a branch at Bordsey Manor, the impression, and he made us all subscribe to this thing. You see, we all had to pay 10 shillings a year or something to be members. So the workshop staff couldn't be full members. They were assistant members. They had to pay 5 shillings a year or something. And he had us all in the library and made us do this. And one of the workshop staff got up, this typical Watson Watt remark for this here, and said, "Excuse me, Sir Robert," he says, "but I don't see what we get for our 5 shillings a year. We don't get the magazine and we don't get a vote." And Sir Robert said, "Mr. Airy," he said, "what you got for your 5 shillings a year is a nucleus of crystallization for systematic representation." I mean, that's Watson Watt all over. I mean, you know, he produced that straight off the cuff. And,
what was the source of his enthusiasm for this professional institution?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Probably a feeling that I don't really know. You see, I never thought he was a really good electronic engineer. I think he was a sort of persuasive talk. He could talk a monkey out of a tree, absolutely. I mean, and his writing. Oh my God, have you tried to read Three Steps of Victory? When I was working with him as a partner, because after the war, after I came back from America, I went to TRE. I didn't know what to do. I was head of the navigation division. And the British government had the feeling that, driven by Watson Watt, that this contribution to civil aviation from the radar developments during the war would be significant, because, of course, the scientists had solved the problems of military AI and G and OBO and all these other things. And that all you had to do to get civil aviation going was to apply some of this to civil aviation, which was relatively backward. So Watson was the head of the delegation to PICAO, which is a provisional international civil aviation organization, which is Montreal after the war. And he was head of the British delegation. They conceived the idea that the official policy was that the Great British put forward the proposal that G should be used as the international method of navigation for civil aircraft. And of course, I was part of the delegation. We had to advance this point of view, which was extremely unpopular with the world's airlines, particularly with the Americans. The Americans had a thing called an omni-range, and a thing which they spent a lot of money on and so on. And of course, as far as they were concerned, G was ludicrous, because first of all, it was an area system. G, fundamentally, it was an area system for defining in an area. And they were concerned more with navigating over long distances between dispersed centers, so it wasn't at all in their way of thinking at all. Secondly, of course, it was relatively heavy, relatively complicated, the operator, and all that stuff. They actually hated it. Now, that was one of the ways I wasted my time after the war.
But with Watson Watts, did he ever develop the sense of grievance that some of the great inventors that we've had seem to have developed later because of lack of recognition from the authorities?
Well, I'm not sure the answer to that, because after the war, I've forgotten when, I got a letter from Boeing, who was in Australia, saying he understood that Watson Watt was going into the Royal Commission on Awards to Inventors for a grant in recognition of the invention of radar. And Boeing said, look, Watson Watt's going to claim the whole blessed thing, which he shouldn't do. I said, I don't want to go in. And he said, oh, yes, you've got to. You must all go in or not. And so 12 of us went in, I think, or 8 of us went in. And Watson was the head one, and we all appeared for the Royal Commission. Watson Inventors, it was an endless thing, government opposing everything, tooth and nail, He got £75,000, which was quite a lot of money in those days. And he got a knighthood, he was basically, his interest, you see, after the war, after I'd been in this navigation division, he approached me and said, look, TRE now, the job's finished, which since the war had finished, we'd beaten the Germans, and we really hadn't any real target in mind. The idea of working on military equipment anymore seemed rather dispiriting, So he said, come and join me as a consulting engineer. And I did, and I joined him in a firm with Lord Bowden and a man called Truefit. The three of us joined him as junior partners in the firm of consulting engineers. And I did the radar for the firm. We had one big firm in England, one big firm in France, one big firm in America, because you can't mix too much consulting because of industrial secrecy. And I did these. I worked for Sperry Gyroscope, and I worked for a firm in France called Les Laboratoires Electroniques, and I worked for COSA in this country as a consultant. And so Watson Watt was busy. He was head of this little firm, and he one day would be seeing J. Arthur Rank and another one somebody else. So as long as he was busy, he was perfectly happy. And I think he was recognised. I mean, he got a considerable sum of money. I think he thought it ought to have been more. But, you know, he got honorary degrees and knighthood and all that sort of thing. But he made a great... His career didn't end up well because, you see, he divorced his wife and went to live in Canada, married a Canadian. She died eventually. And then he married the head WAF, whose name I've forgotten, you know, the woman who was head of the WAFs. She died eventually too. But the point was that when he went to... Our firm was successful. We had this small, high-class firm in Westminster of consultants. It was successful. We had as much clientele as we could possibly handle. This kept the little man busy. But the point was that when he went to Canada with his lady friend, who was a Canadian, and divorced his wife, he said, I will move the firm to Canada. We will do the same thing in Canada. But I said to him, no, you cannot do that in Canada, because the only reason you're successful in England is that you know everybody from the king downwards, which is true, he did. And so, you know, your contacts won't work in Canada. Canada's not the same place. There may be an old boy network, but it's not old English boys. Anyhow, we wouldn't go with him. Lord Bowden went to Manchester, and I went to join Sir Bernard Lovell at Jodrell Bank, and... So we let him go, and he got new partners. He went broke. And then he went to America and lived on some estate, prestigious estate, I don't know what it was, but anyhow, he ended up in Scotland, I think, but I think he ended up almost broke, I think. It wasn't a very happy ending, really, in a sense. But that wasn't lack of recognition. I don't think he would have felt that, really.
Just miscalculation, really.
Yes, miscalculation, yes, because he would have done quite well if he'd stayed on with his firm in England, I think. But he was no businessman, no businessman.